On this 10th day of May 2011 in San Diego, we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We are in Chapter 2, Contents of the Gita Summarized, Text 19. Yaenam veti hantaram.
Yaenam veti hantaram.
Yaschainam manyate hatam.
Yaschainam manyate hatam.
Ubhautau na vijanito.
Ubhautau na vijanito.
Nayam handi na hanyate.
Nayam handi na hanyate.
Neither he who thinks the living entity the slayer, nor he who thinks it slain, is in knowledge, for the self slays not, nor is slain. Purport, when an embodied living entity is hurt by fatal weapons, it is to be known that the living entity within the body is not killed. The spirit soul is so small that it is impossible to kill him by any material weapon, as will be evident from subsequent verses. Nor is the living entity killable because of his spiritual constitution. What is killed, or is supposed to be killed, is the body only. This, however, does not at all encourage killing of the body. The Vedic injunction is Ma hingsyat sarva bhutani, never commit violence to anyone. Nor does understanding that the living entity is not killed encourage animal slaughter. Killing the body of anyone without authority is abominable and is punishable by the law of the state as well as the law of the Lord. Arjuna, however, is being engaged in killing for the principle of religion, not whimsically. Om Gyanatamarandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Meditam Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisance to him and all members of Sri Parampara. So, the basic principle that's being spoken of here in this early part of Krishna's instructions. Krishna begins his actual instructions to Arjuna in the 11th verse of this chapter. And the main thrust of what he's saying is that the body and the soul and the self are two distinct entities. The body is obviously temporary. It's born at a certain time and it's going to pass away, never to be again. But the consciousness, the self, was never born and never dies. And this understanding of the difference between the self and the body is essential for as a foundation for any further spiritual understanding. Now, this verse and the next verse talks a lot about killing and not killing, because Arjuna's on a battlefield. And the whole context of this conversation is that Krishna is trying to convince Arjuna to actually fight in the war. This battle that's about to take place, what you have in your hand here are just 18 chapters out of hundreds and hundreds of a much larger work called the Mahabharata, which is a very elaborate history of India, a certain historical period of India, centering on this critical battle between good and evil, if you will. That's basically what it is. And at the last moment, Arjuna, they're sitting on a chariot. Krishna has taken the position as the charioteer. And Arjuna is wants him to take a chariot between the two armies. They're standing with, you know, facing each other, all prepared to fight. And Arjuna wants to see who's going to fight on the other side, who's come to battle with me in this very great war. And as soon as he does that, he sees on the other side his teacher, Dronacharya. He sees the worshipable grandfather of the whole dynasty, Bhishma. And he sees many others who he's tied to, either through blood relationships or family relationships or just friends. And he has cold feet. He doesn't want to fight because he's going to kill his loved ones, his dear ones, his most revered teacher, etc. So this is the context. But if he doesn't fight, then his side is going to lose. He's the main fighter on the side of the good. So Krishna is speaking this, at least the structure of it, he's speaking this knowledge to Arjuna to convince him that it's good and right for you to fight in this battle, even though you're going to be responsible for killing your dear ones, those who are related to you through bodily relationship. So that's the context, and therefore we find in this verse that we just read about killing and not killing, that the living entity within the body is never really does anything. What we do is that we desire. We desire things to happen. And as soon as we desire something to happen, there's a whole... here, why don't you put that under the book? Hello? Hare Krishna? Just put it under the book. Oh, there's a bug? Oh, there's a little mosquito. I don't think he will hurt you. He was a former student here, actually, and he's coming back. He doesn't bite. You can whisk him away if he's bothering you. Okay, he won't bite. So what's happening here is that Krishna is giving Arjun the basic spiritual knowledge that the soul is different from the body. So what happens when we do anything? If the soul is not doing anything, I'm not actually doing anything, then how are things going on? Well, what we do is we desire for things to happen. And then there's a whole mechanism for how that manifests in some physical activity or mental activity. There is a structure of understanding within each body. This Krishna will explain this a little later, that there's actually two souls. There is an expansion of the Supreme Soul, God, we call the Super Soul. And then there's the individual soul. And in each and every body, and in each and every atom, there's this Super Soul, an expansion of God. So we can say God is everywhere. It's true. He's everywhere. And that means consciousness is everywhere. So when we want to do something, that desire is understood by this Supreme Soul. And the whole material energy that's going on is really going on under the supervision of that Supreme Soul. And sometimes, in our even though we want something to happen, it doesn't happen. Suppose my hand becomes paralyzed. I may want to pick up this glass of water, but I can't. It's just not happening. It's not part of my... I'm not due to do that anymore. It's not feasible. And there's so many things that we want on a larger level that don't come true. There's many things that we don't want that happen to us. So ultimately, we're not in control. We have a small amount of control, seem to anyway. And this is how things are going on. So that's why he says, the soul never actually slays anyone, nor is slain. The soul is, or the spirit, or the atma, the self, is eternal. It never dies, it's never born. So, as Srila Prabhupada says in this purport or commentary, this doesn't justify whimsical killing. It certainly doesn't justify animal slaughter. Because there is a higher law. If there is a conscious being who's pervading everything, there's also a conscious control, and there's a law. Just like in the state, there are laws. We don't make them. You know, we don't make them. There's a higher authority that makes them and enforces them. Okay, they may represent all of us together, but we're not independent to do anything that we want. And if we violate that law and we get caught, then we're punished. Similarly, there's a natural law that's under the control of this supreme consciousness. And part of that law is that no living entity can cause suffering to another without good cause, without a higher cause. Just on our own desire, if we want to kill someone or want to hurt someone or want to eat another living being, then if it's against the higher law, then we get punished. There's karma, karmic law, you see, that we have to suffer for. So, but in this particular case, Krishna is attempting to convince Arjun that because the higher desire of that supreme being is that this battle take place and dharma be reinstated, religion be reinstated in the world. In other words, evil is vanquished and good prevails. Therefore, there will be no sin for your killing. It's just like in any battle, if there's a, say, World War II. I think everyone can, that was a good fight, right? We were on the... Yeah, that was a good war. So you get a medal if you kill more of the enemy, right? But if you come home, because it's sanctioned, but if you come back from the battle and you get into a fight in the bar and you kill someone, then you're punished. because it's on your own account. So the whole point here is that it depends on what is your motive, what is the ultimate purpose for anything that you do. And the basic principle here, which will be reiterated in the next verse, which is very important, is that the soul never dies. You're not actually killing anyone. And if it's done for the higher, generally a higher cause, then there's no sin involved. There's no bad reaction. But if you do it on your own account, then you're interfering with the livelihood of others, and therefore there will be a karmic reaction. So that's the basic principle of this verse. Any questions, comments? Or we can go on to the next one. Okay, let's go to the next verse. Very important verse. Jayate mriyate vakadachin. Nayam bhutva bhavitava nabhuya. Ajo nitya shashvato yam purano. Nahanyate hanyamane sharire. For the soul, there is neither birth nor death at any time. He has not come into being, does not come into being, and will not come into being. He is unborn, eternal, ever-existing, and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. Purport. Qualitatively, the small atomic fragmental part of the Supreme Spirit is one with the Supreme. He undergoes no changes like the body. Sometimes the soul is called the steady or the kutastha. The body is subject to six kinds of transformations. It takes its birth from the womb of the mother's body, remains for some time, grows, produces some effects, gradually dwindles, and at last vanishes into oblivion. The soul, however, does not go through such changes. The soul is not born, but because he takes on a material body, the body takes its birth. The soul does not take birth there. The soul does not die. Anything which has birth also has death. And because the soul has no birth, he therefore has no past, present, or future. He is eternal, ever-existing, and primeval. That is, there is no trace in history of his coming into being. Under the impression of the body, we seek the history of birth, etc., of the soul. The soul does not at any time become old, as the body does. The so-called old man, therefore, feels himself to be in the same spirit as in his childhood or youth. The changes of the body do not affect the soul. The soul does not deteriorate like a tree, nor anything material. The soul has no byproduct either. The byproducts of the body, namely children, are also different individual souls, and owing to the body, they appear as children of a particular man. The body develops because of the soul's presence, but the soul has neither offshoots nor change. Therefore, the soul is free from the six changes of the body. In the Katha Upanishad 1:2:18, we also find a similar passage, which reads, "Jayate mrite vava paschin nayam kutaschin nambabhuvat kaschit ajo nityak shastrato yam purano nahanyate hanyamane sharire." The meaning and purport of this verse is the same as in the Bhagavad Gita. But here in this verse, there is one special word, vipaschit, which means learned or with knowledge. The soul is full of knowledge, or full always with consciousness. Therefore, consciousness is the symptom of the soul. Even if one does not find the soul within the heart where he is situated, one can still understand the presence of the soul simply by the presence of consciousness. Sometimes we do not find the sun in the sky or into clouds or for some other reason, but the light of the sun is always there, and we are convinced that it is therefore daytime. As soon as there is a little light in the sky early in the morning, we can understand that the sun is in the sky. Similarly, since there is some consciousness in all bodies, whether man or animal, we can understand the presence of the soul. The consciousness of the soul is, however, different from the consciousness of the Supreme, because the Supreme consciousness is all knowledge, past, present, and future. The consciousness of the individual soul is prone to be forgetful. When he is forgetful of his real nature, he obtains education and enlightenment from the superior lessons of Krishna. But Krishna is not like the forgetful soul. If so, Krishna's teachings of the Bhagavad Gita would be useless. There are two kinds of souls, namely the minute particle soul, the Anu Atma, and the supersoul, the vibhu atman. This is also confirmed in the Katha Upanishad 1-20 in this way. Anoraniyan mahato mahiyam atmasta janto nihito gohayam tamakratu paschati vita shoko datu prasadan mahimanam atmanah. Both the supersoul, the paramatma, and the atomic soul, the jivatma, are situated on the same tree of the body within the same heart of the living being. And only one who has become free from all material desires as well as lamentations can, by the grace of the Supreme, understand the glories of the soul. Krishna is the fountainhead of the supersoul also, as it will be disclosed in the following chapters. And Arjuna is the atomic soul, forgetful of his real nature. Therefore, he requires to be enlightened by Krishna or by his bona fide representative, the spiritual master. So this verse is kind of a summary verse of the whole ideas we presented earlier and subsequently, that the soul is never born and never dies. Now, this is a kind of a revolutionary subject or a piece of knowledge, because if we understand this, then it changes our whole perspective of who we are and what we should do in life. Because if we think about it, the default position is simply to act on the basis of our identity as this body. We have a certain age, we have a certain gender, we have a certain family, a race, a place of birth, a clan. All of these things are related to the body, where we happen to take our birth. But if we broaden our perspective, this is what one of the meanings of the word mahatma. This is like an English word, you know. But mahatma literally means broad-minded. And looking at the larger perspective of life, what is the long-term goal of our existence? Not just this one body, but where have we been heading, and what is our destiny from time immemorial to eternal time? That's what it means to really enter into the spirit of the Bhagavad Gita. So as soon as we understand, I have no beginning and I have no ending, this changes everything. Because generally, we're just absorbed in, well, what's the immediate needs that I have. And if I have a long-term plan, okay, let me get an education, I get a good job, you know, let me go here, go there, I have certain plans. But they only last maybe a few years. But that's nothing compared to our eternal existence, is it? If this is really true. So, and the tragedy is that the soul, we have a desire to return to our original nature. The original nature is eternity, eternal life, but also full knowledge and, you know, infinite happiness and bliss called ananda. So we're not like that now. In our material situation, we're certainly not eternal. We're certainly not full of knowledge. There's so many things we don't know. We don't know who we are. We don't know what the good is. What to speak of bliss? That, you know, life is a series of ups and downs. There's a few periods of happiness and pleasure. And ultimately, you know, as you get older, you're faced with this kind of frightening aspect of getting old, getting diseased, and dying. You know, that's not pleasant. You know, so no one can argue that we're happy all the time. But this is what we're told and you know, explained by the great scriptures here, is that this is our heritage. We have this nature of being unlimitedly happy and free from this deterioration of old age, disease, and death, and rebirth. So that's the mission of the living entity, according to all Eastern philosophies, not just Vaishnavism or other aspects of Hinduism or Buddhism or anything, is to reach this period, is to escape the bonds of matter and to be reinstated in this eternal spiritual life, which is full of happiness. So how to do that? Well, it means, first of all, changing the sense of who we are and what our mission in life is. Because if we ourselves have no death, then we need to live our lives on that platform. And that means not placing all of our sense of importance and value on the temporary things of this life. This is the disease of the soul, is that we've forgotten our eternal nature, we've forgotten the Supreme, and we're simply thinking in terms of our temporary identity. And we should know that we actually have two bodies. This is another thing that comes out. We have the gross, what we call the gross body, which we can weigh on the scale. But more importantly, we have the inner body. We have our mind. We have our thoughts. We have our emotions. We have the intelligence. We have the ego. These are all things you can't measure, but this is really where we live, right? Is in our consciousness. And that subtle body, we call the subtle body, doesn't die with the gross body. We are forming that daily and moment by moment as we live our lives. Who we hang out with, what books we read, what music we listen to, what foods we eat. Basically, how we associate with our environment is formulating our consciousness. You know, we all know that. The mind is like a sponge. It's being exposed to all different things through the senses, right? We're exposed to the ideas in other minds by reading, right? Or by hearing. And, you know, when we see a piece of art, you know, then that person's consciousness is affecting us. When we see a movie, when we anything like that, you know, we're exposed, and also the things that we do, the words we speak, the things that we choose to do. All of it is extremely complicated, and all of it goes into making what we call our consciousness. That is the template of our next body, because when this body is just a machine. It's a complicated machine, and like all machines, they eventually wear out, and you have to get a new one. And since the body is eternal, or the soul is eternal, what determines where he goes? You know, where that soul, what body are you going to get? That's your consciousness. We're making our destiny now, every day, every moment. So the question is, how can we formulate our consciousness in such a way for the best destination? This is called Shreya. There's a word in Sanskrit called Shreya. And in when Arjuna surrenders to Krishna and he agrees to be a student, he uses this word Shreya. He said, I don't know. You know, we have to really say, well, I have no idea. You know, I think I'm working for my best interest, but then as life goes on, you know, as you get older, you say, oh, why did I do that? You know, I went this way, I should have gone that way. I invested my energy, my attention, my money in this direction. Some relationship, boy, that was a big mistake. You know? That happens, right? Or, you know, I mean, just an investment. Do I need to, you know, that name, Bernie Madoff? You know? A lot of people, you know who Bernie Madoff is? Okay. Bernie Madoff was a crook, a big-time crook. He stole billions from unsuspecting people who invested. They thought they were getting a report, oh, my investments are making so much money. But it was all on paper, right? There's
never
nothing there.
He never even bought the security he was showing.
It's called Ponzi.
It was a
Ponzi scheme.
Basically getting new people to pay off the
people. Yeah, in other words, you know, trust me. You know, the whole thing is trust. It's a con game, confidence game.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's a con
game. But big time confidence game. You know? So the idea is that material life is like that. It's all like that. It's all a Ponzi scheme. You're thinking that you're investing in your ultimate benefit, but you're ignoring the needs of the soul. You know, you're simply investing in the welfare of this body, but you're not the body. And eventually the body goes. What happens to the soul? I don't know. I could become a dog or cat in my next life. We have a miserable life if I make that kind of consciousness. You know, or even lower. Where do you think that mosquito that you swished away? Maybe he went outside eventually.
I think they
live in the fountain, you know. Anyway, we'll discuss it later. But, yeah. that's the same soul. That mosquito has the same soul that we have. The soul is irreducible. It's just a quantum of consciousness. But because of some, you know, horrific activity, that consciousness is now covered to such a degree that he's just a little insect. Where can I find some warm body where that food is? Doesn't even know that it's hurting you when it comes in. Then, you know, then you slap it. That's it. Oh, finished. It moves on to the next body. There's a whole hierarchy. The insects, they come, maybe the birds, you know, animals, and finally human beings. There's a high point in the evolution. But if you misuse the human life, then you can go down again. This is the tragic situation we find ourselves. So, how do we formulate our consciousness in such a way that we don't have to face another birth? so that we can actually go back to our eternal home in the spiritual world for that eternal life of bliss and knowledge. That is the process of yoga, bhakti yoga. And it involves, first of all, understanding who we actually are. I'm spirit, but that's not all. I'm consciousness, but that's not all. I'm part of the supreme spirit, the supreme consciousness. And my position is, my actual natural position of satisfaction and happiness is to serve. To serve the interests of the supreme. That's Arjuna's whole journey here, journey of self-discovery. He's going to come to the conclusion, yes, my position is I should serve Krishna, and that will be right. Even though it seems like against my interest because I'm going to have to kill my friends. You know, no one wants to kill his friends and his worshipable, you know, teacher. You know, but this is the interest of the Supreme. I have to do it. And ultimately it's good, even though I may not see it right away. So this point, just going over this verse, that we are qualitatively one with God. You know, we are godly. We're divine. Divine beings. Every one of us. Even that mosquito is divine. But look, see how it's lost its divinity. You know. So, to regain that divine nature requires a process, a discipline, a sadhana. And that sadhana or practice is yoga. And the kind of yoga that we practice is called bhakti yoga. It's devotional yoga. And it involves all of our being, every one of our senses, and our mind, every function. There's a spiritual way to eat, there's a spiritual way to work, to do everything. And if we find out how to do that, we according to the teachers who have gone before and achieved this process, then we can gradually become, even in this lifetime, you don't have to wait till after death, to become very happy and peaceful and return to the spiritual world after we leave this body. No longer to face birth and death. That's the, you know, that's the, one of the goals. Okay, any questions on this point? These points? Yes?
Is the restroom? Yeah.
Restroom is there. You can show where it is. Yeah. Okay, let us go on. Text 21. Vedavinashinam nityam. Yahinam ajam avyayam. Katam supodashak parta kangati yati hantikam. O Partha, how can a person who knows that the soul is indestructible, eternal, unborn, and immutable kill anyone or cause anyone to kill? Purport, everything has its proper utility, and a man who is situated in complete knowledge knows how and where to apply a thing for its proper utility. Similarly, violence also has its utility, and how to apply violence rests with the person in knowledge. Although the justice of the peace awards capital punishment to a person condemned for murder, the justice of the peace cannot be blamed because he orders violence to another person according to the codes of justice. In the Manu Samhita, the law book for mankind, it is supported that a murderer should be condemned to death so that in his next life he will not have to suffer for the great sin he has committed. Therefore, the king's punishment of hanging a murderer is actually beneficial. Similarly, when Krishna orders fighting, it must be concluded that violence is for supreme justice, and thus Arjuna should follow the instruction, knowing well that such violence committed in the act of fighting for Krishna is not violence at all, because at any rate, the man, or rather the soul, cannot be killed. So for the administration of justice, so-called violence is permitted. A surgical operation is not meant to kill a patient, but to cure him. Therefore, the fighting to be executed by Arjuna at the instruction of Krishna is with full knowledge, so there is no possibility of sinful reaction. So here's this idea, a very important principle, that our knowledge informs our action. Whatever we do is according to some idea that this is the best thing, that I'm doing something for myself, you know. So if you understand the implications of your activity, then you may refrain from the activity, or you may do something that you ordinarily wouldn't do, right? Just like the classic Sweet rice. Suppose you're going to drink a nice glass of carrot juice. All right? Carrot juice is good for you. So, carrot juice is all ready, and you're about to drink it, and someone comes into the room and says, no, don't drink it. You know? There's cyanide in it. Sorry, it slipped in when I wasn't looking. Don't drink that. So, your knowledge that you just gained is going to change your behavior. Right? Suddenly, that carrot juice, which you were imagining is going to taste good, it's going to really do me good. It still may taste good at first, but it's not going to do you any good. and right away, you completely don't want to, you know, you say, whoa, you immediately pour it down the drain and says, well, thank you for saving me. So you were saved by knowledge. It changed your activity. Your whole view of, you know, that thing that seemed to be pleasurable, you realize isn't. Now, therefore, Krishna says, Veda Avinashinam, one who knows that the soul is indestructible and eternal, then you realize, I'm not actually killing anyone. And the only way that really works is if you're not doing it on your own account. You know? You're doing it on, just like the executioner, it's not a very nice job, but he's not responsible. It's not like he's responsible for killing this person or, you know, pulling the switch or anything. He's doing it on the higher order. Oh, this is justice. There's something, justice is being done here. And as we learn from the Manu Samhita, it's also justice for the person who's being executed. Because he would have to suffer much more karma-wise. You may not see it, but if that, you know, punishment weren't meted out. So when Krishna, who's the ultimate knower and the definer and the enforcer of dharma, when he wants to do something, then it's right and good. That's the only, if there's any criterion for understanding what is right and what is wrong, it has to be for the coming down from the supreme controller, the one who also has the best interest of everyone at heart. You know. That's an absolute necessity for understanding that there's a God. He's all powerful and all good. Now, I was just reading about that. You know, the Western theology, they have no idea how to deal with this subject. There's a whole part of Western theology called theodicy, and theodicy deals with how can there be evil in the world? Is God good or not? Is He all good? Is He powerful? And how could He allow there to be evil? Why do children get diseased? Why do they get killed in war? You know, why do innocent women get practically always the victims in warfare? You know, just taking care of the kids, the bomb falls down. Why? Is there, you know? If there's a real God, how could He let these things happen? And this is often the way in which people lose their faith. Because what did I do? You know, the point is that not only do I see the evil happening, but it's happening to me. I was just minding my own business, and somebody, you know, comes up and robs me. Or does something even worse, you know. Or there's a war or some, you know, this thing that happened in Japan. All of a sudden, this huge earthquake and, like, you know, devastation everywhere, danger from radioactivity. What do? They're just old people living out there. Because you don't see. You know, it's just like if you walk into a courtroom, you're not aware really what's going on. And you see there's a nice young man there, dressed nicely, sitting very peacefully. And there are people accusing him of all kinds of things, you know, and he's about to get sent off to jail for 25 years. What are they doing to that poor young man? He's just like such a nice guy, you know. You don't know that there's a history there. He committed a crime. He may look very innocent now. Similarly, the innocent child, we just learned there's no birth and no death, right? So that nobody is a child. You know, we're sitting here, some of us are 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years old. No. We're each billions and billions of years old. We happen to be occupying this particular body at this particular time, and which has made us forget. We've forgotten all of this past. But that past, everything that we've done, is affecting who we are at this very moment and what's going to happen to us when we walk out this door. That's called the law of karma. It acts over many, many years and lifetimes. Now, what can we do about that? If we accept, theoretically, that we're part of this larger scheme that we can't really fathom on our own. How can we work for our own good? What is that good? That we have to learn from this higher source of knowledge and how to access it. And so, yes, God is good. Yes, God is all-powerful. And when we see the innocent suffer, we should know the fallacy is no one is innocent. Not that we condone, you know, the suffering of little children. Believe me, that's not the part of the philosophy. But the understanding is that there's a higher law involved, and there's a whole history here culminating in what appears to be innocent people suffering. And the same thing is true on the other side. Why is this person, so, you know, from day one, you know, traditional, born with a silver spoon in their mouth, you know? He had all the advantages. Good education, nice parents, wealth, you know, he or she. Whereas so many millions of others are suffering, they're born into this. It's called karma. You know. Now, how to navigate this, you know, it's very difficult because we don't see all these things working. Therefore, we have to hook up to the plan of the controller. You know, if we know the judge and we know the policeman and they're our friends and we're good people, we know that, well, we're not going to suffer. You know, we're in good hands here. You know, but if you're a criminal, you're always hiding. You know, you're afraid. You see. So we need to know the law and the lawmaker and act according to that the laws and what the lawmaker wants, which is what law means. And then our auspicious life opens up. And it begins, you know, in a very simple way, by linking up through consciousness, thinking about Krishna. Just thinking about Krishna. And by thinking about Krishna, in many ways, just hearing his words here is a very important way, Bhagavad Gita, and the words of his devotee, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And what will, and as he will explain, there's different ways of meditating, you know, linking the mind up. The best way in this age is this mantra here, is the name. Just by chanting the name, it's so powerful, we don't know how it works. It's just like a medicine. If you take it, it works. Do you have to know how it works? No, it works. And this medicine of chanting the holy name immediately changes everything. Suddenly, you know, we don't know how many eons of karma have been wiped away, been changed, just by the sound vibration. This is the mystical aspect of this practice of yoga. And it's recommended by all of these great scholars and spiritually realized souls, beginning with Srila Prabhupada, but he has a whole line of realized souls behind him. Just like I was chanting at the beginning, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So there's a whole line, and it's proven. It's just like a scientific experiment. It can be replicated, right? If it can be replicated, it's not scientific. So this process of Krishna consciousness has been replicated millions of times. You know, so many people, they start out in ignorance and desperation and don't know what's what. But if you take up this process, beginning with the chanting, then from within the heart and outside, the knowledge starts to expand, and you're on the auspicious path. And we can realize some of these very statements that Krishna is making here, especially in the next one. I don't think we have time about how the body is just like an old coat. You know, you take off the old coat, put a new one on. That's death and rebirth. Yeah.
Yeah. So one question I have is the knowledge that is being talked about in this verse. It must be fully realized knowledge, because a person cannot just read Bhagavad this verse today that one who knows the self is indestructible can go ahead and, you know, he doesn't kill. So he could then say, I read it yesterday, now I have this knowledge, I'm going to take the gun and kill someone. So his idea is fully, so he's not, like you're saying, he's not acting on his own accord.
That's very clear. Yeah.
So he's fully in touch with his self and the supreme self. Only then, otherwise somebody just because somebody theoretically knows or because he heard it just once.
What does it mean to know?
What kind of knowledge is it about? Is it fully self-realized knowledge or just theoretical knowledge or just something you heard once? Or?
If you actually know the spiritual nature, then you immediately have to know I'm part of the Supreme Spirit and I have to work in accord with the desires. And the basic principle, as reiterated here and in other purports, is that it's nonviolence.
Yes.
In other words, violence it can be used, but it's just like the, you know, the violence of a surgeon. You know, he uses that knife, but he uses it for good. To the outside observer, he says, oh, he's cutting up that poor woman's body. You know, right? Well, wait a minute, the person has a disease, you know, you're helping them. It looks like violence. So Krishna applies violence in that way. This is a surgical operation, you know, and ultimately the body politic, if you will, the world itself will be much better for it, because Dharma will be reinstated as the ruler in the person of Yudhishthira, Arjuna's elder brother. And so, but the natural position of a devotee is to do absolutely as little violence as possible. This is why this mosquito is still living very peacefully in this temple. We didn't snap him because he's non-violent. You know, he hasn't bitten anyone. And instead, you see the devotees walk around. They chant, you know, like rosary, Hare Krishna. And we're walking around, and we see an insect. Oh my goodness! Get a little piece of paper, take him out, put him in there. Whereas an ordinary person just boom, slap, you know. But that's a living entity. That's a soul. He's also living his life. You know, why hurt someone? Unnecessary. What to speak of what we eat? That's why we're vegetarian. We don't eat any meat, because you know it's just like if you just expand your consciousness a little bit and you see all the suffering that's going on by eating meat. Why? Is it not? I've been a vegetarian for 40 years. No one's going to tell me that I didn't get enough protein. You know, it's perfectly healthy, more healthy, and tasty. You know, you learn how to cook from the Hare Krishnas. You know, we're famous for it. So there's no reason. There's no reason to drink. There's no reason to smoke. There's no reason to eat meat. It's just bad habits. You know, for a little bit of pleasure, a lot of pain, a lot of pain. Not for you and for the person you're causing. For what? It's not necessary. So giving up all these unnecessary things and leading a pure life is part of Krishna consciousness.
One more comment I have. You mentioned that is there could be someone who's thinking, oh, I was just minding my own business. Actually, that is a problem because he was minding his own personal self-education business, which means entanglement, which means karma, which means bonds, sometimes upper, sometimes lower, and then, you know, all kind of experiences, including the one he's going through now. So that itself just minds.
We have to know what our own business really is.
Really, the real business.
If we're minding the business of the body, then it's not.
That itself is the root cause.
I was just thinking the other day the difference in the qualification of what a saint is in kind of the Western culture versus the Krishna conscious world, the Vedic world. Like a saint, you know, before I came here and started learning about meditative qualities, is someone who, you know, every so often maybe donates a couple dollars or something to some charitable organization, or says hi to random people, or does some charitable work every so often. But here, it's like that person may still be considered demonic, basically. I mean, a real saint is giving everything, I mean, his very self to all humanity, all living beings, all the time, no matter what.
There are some real saints in the Christian tradition. I mean, you know, Saint Francis and others who really had a good, you know, grasp of that aspect. At least the part that God is in everything, you know, and then don't do any violence, you know, unnecessarily. And because of their austerity, you know, they have a certain amount of advancement, but it's limited because they don't know the details. Like I have this phrase, God is in the details. You know, if we're, you know, who can argue? We're persons, right? But as we just understood, the personhood resides in our consciousness. The body is just an expression. Even if I, like, you know, God forbid, I may lose a hand, I'm still a person, you know, but I can't do as much as I did before. So that personhood really resides in my consciousness, and the body gives expression to it. So the supreme consciousness must be a person also. If the individual beings are persons, then that personhood must reside in the supreme. And you know, personhood also involves activities and form. Therefore, there must be senses. You know, not senses made of flesh and blood, but still a certain kind of sense. And understanding that is beyond the Christian theology. The full personality of Godhead, meaning the activities, what he looks like. If he's infinitely knowledgeable and powerful, omniscient and omnipotent, why not infinitely beautiful? Is there any logic? No. Beauty has to be there. You going to say?
I had a question.
Go ahead.
Is there such thing as innocence then?
Innocence?
Mm-hmm. True innocence.
Yes, there is. That innocence is when one is fully in tune with the desires of God. That is real innocence.
Okay. I think lack of duplicity you can also say, because he's innocent, because he's not duplicitous, because childlike, you know.
Yeah, but that, I mean, the real innocence means to have no interest separate from the Lord, and to be completely dependent. And just like a child is dependent, you know, and it takes its cue from the mother or the father, you know. So when we take our cue from the Lord, then we're innocent. And what's wonderful about it is that we're redeemed, this idea of redemption. All of our previous sin and activity, vicious, however bad they may have been, are erased, are given up. This is very hopeful. So from whatever point we begin, we can it's completely succeed in this, you know, purification.
Yes, because I just was wondering that, because earlier you were saying about child suffering and perhaps previous karma that they might have done. So I was thinking, is there an instance where the child might not have done something to deserve what he was doing, or he's innocent?
Well, if he's suffering some grievous disease or something, then that's a record that there is something in the background. Just the fact of having a physical body is a sign that we're not pure, you know. So every one of us. So we're going to have a little ceremony now. You're invited. A little Hare Krishna chanting. Yeah. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.